Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. So glad to have you back with us. Peter Phillips is with us, Dr. Peter Phillips. He manages the Sonoma State University's student-run media research group. It's called Project Censored. Hey, Dr. Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here, Tom.
Oh, very glad to have you right here in the studio with us here in Portland, Oregon. Tonight in Portland, at Portland State University, you guys are going to be passing out your awards?
We did that last weekend, actually, at Sonoma State University, and I'm just speaking at Portland State tonight to a group of people there.
So, oh, okay.
We had our award winners Saturday night from all over the country came into Sonoma State, and I remember that 2 years ago you were an award winner,
yep.
And had two stories in the 2004 book,
yep.
About corporate personhood and corporations lying to the public.
Yes.
So it's good to meet you in person.
It's great meeting you, Peter, and I was very, very honored to be to have been included in the book, and I'm very pleased to put Project Censored award winning, you know, in my bio. It's good company.
It's a way, you know, you kind of get censored by corporate media, but in the other sense, it's saying, and 200 faculty and students are saying, that was a darn good story.
Yeah, yeah. And there were some darn good stories in each one of these books. And what you guys do is you turn this into a book, and the book is, of course, available in bookstores all across the country. And it's called, this year, it's called Censored 2006, Media Democracy in Action.
Exactly.
There you go. So people can check that out. ProjectCensored.org, the website. And Peter Phillips, go through a few of these things. The Bush administration has made some really substantial moves to shut down the access of we the people to the information about what's going on inside our government. This really contradicts the foundational notions of democracy, and yet I doubt most Americans even know what's going on.
Well, we had the Freedom of Information Act that has been in public law now for some close to 30 years, and that we've been whittling away at that. So the Reagan administration, Bush 1, and Bush 2 now, I mean, they're really shutting down how we can get access to government information. They keep coming up with new exceptions, new secrets. Current military operations are now exempt. Environmental impact report for military bases that you can't really find anything out. Anything that has to do with weapons of mass destruction, anything that has to do with corporations telling things that they've done wrong to government is not public information. I mean, if they've promised to correct it, then it's not part of EPA's
really?
Report.
So if you or I confess to a crime as a human being, if we go in and say, yesterday I was over at the Walmart and I shoplifted a candy bar, and they decide to arrest us, that becomes part of a public record. Arrest records are public. And take our
pictures. But with corporations, you promise not to do it again, it's okay.
Well, it's not just okay.
It's secret. Yes, it's proprietary.
I can't go to the government and say, you know,
let me have that information.
Right.
No,
I can't. There's no way.
That's where they're closing the doors.
Now, the Bush administration. You said the Reagan administration and the Bush administration. I'm assuming you mean both Bush administrations. Didn't Clinton reverse that? I mean, he went on a declassifying binge, as I recall. I know at least with regard to the Kennedy assassination, a lot of documents got declassified.
Well, that was ancient process? History.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, one of the first things Bush got in when he got in was to delete the records and to hold the records on the presidency from his father.
Right.
And Clinton there were some things that Clinton opened up, but there was a lot of things that had to do with the war against Serbia and the double dealing that went on there that didn't get covered in the corporate media and we really didn't know about. I mean, the Rambouillet Treaty had a section in it that would have allowed NATO troops to occupy Yugoslavia. And, of course, Milosevic wasn't going along with that, whether we liked him or not. We kind of forced the hand on that. So there was plenty of stuff that went on during the Clinton administration as well.
Interesting. That never got covered.
That never got covered. Yeah.
So how do you know that?
Well, it was published in independent media in Europe, mm-hmm. and other places. And But here, Clinton used a group called the Rendon Group to help make that war look like it was a humanitarian war.
Right.
And the Rendon Group now works for the White House and helps process the Iraq war today.
So if we've digressed a little bit, but I want to get back to the book, but I find this fascinating. If the Because I don't, frankly, I have to confess, I don't know that much about that particular war, the Bosnian War. I was in other places doing other things at the time. I wasn't even in the United States for some of it. And if it wasn't a humanitarian war, I mean, we saw for weeks, you know, the siege of Sarajevo and, you know, people starving and people being shot at by snipers.
It was a terrible civil war.
Yeah. And so if our intervention was not humanitarian, why did we do it?
Well, there's... we broke up what was the last remaining socialist country in Europe. That was a motivating factor right from the beginning, and the Germans and the U.S. were very much involved. When the Mujahideen quit fighting in Afghanistan, we actually helped airlift several thousand of them into Bosnia to fight against the Serbs. And that happened in 92. And so this whole thing just got stirred up. I mean, and that's been part of what... You know, there's nobody innocent in this.
Yeah, no, if that happened in 92,
civil
that
wars,
stuff that was
civil
set up
wars are nasty relationships.
Sure.
And so there's no innocentness here. The drugs, the main drugs from Afghanistan were flowing through mostly to Europe through the KLA in Kosovo. Now, Camp Bond Steel is one of the biggest military bases in the world. It's plopped right in the middle of Kosovo where they want to build an oil pipeline across there. So when they bring the oil across the Black Sea from the Caspian Sea area and they bring it across the Black Sea, it doesn't have to go through Turkey and the straits there, which are so narrow. They can just pump it right straight across Kosovo into the Mediterranean on the other side.
So the oil companies benefited. The illegal drug trade benefited.
There were lots of corporations that benefited and continue to benefit. I mean, Halliburton and Brown & Root operate that whole big base there, making millions of dollars in
Kosovo.
Yeah. And we put NATO bases all throughout in Croatia and Bosnia. So we've occupied the region, broken it up, balkanized the entire place. And really, it's created Yugoslavia really was a first world country in many aspects. It was highly developed, and it's become pauperized. And we left a permanent radioactive landscape with depleted uranium weapons throughout Serbia.
Right. Not unlike what we're doing in Iraq right now.
No, exactly.
Now, if this started in 92, that was the last year of Bush Sr.'s administration, was it not?
Well,
so Clinton
was never
inherited this?
Clinton was never supposed to get in. Yes, he did inherit it. He was never supposed to get in. And, you know, a lot of times...
As president, you mean?
Right. He was a governor. Bush was supposed to continue. And it really threw a monkey wrench into the global dominance group, which is the PNACers and the people who are in power today, the Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Khalilzad. I mean, that whole group that were looking for after the collapse of the Soviet Union for the U.S. to go ahead and have the New World Order where we're going to create a top-down control militarily of the entire globe. Clinton didn't follow that agenda exactly the way we wanted it. And they were writing letters to Clinton saying it's time to invade Iraq in 98, and all of that was coming forward. They're
well,
writing
proudly.
Reports.
I mean, those letters are still on the Project for New American Ascension.
They're still on
website.
Their website, exactly, yeah. With, you know, the signatures of the people who are in power today.
Yeah, including Jeb Bush and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and Rumsfeld
all
and
above.
Cheney. Yeah.
But a bunch of those were Northrop Grumman people, Lockheed Martin people. Who really have benefited from the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq and continue to make they're the most profitable corporations in the country next to media.
Right, which means in the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this really is a perfect segue into the issue of, okay, here's all this stuff that's been going on. Most people don't know about it. I confess, as I said, with regard to Serbia anyway, I'm certainly not a scholar of that war. And I don't think most Americans are informed about these things. You suggest in the title of your book, Censored 2006, and the whole, you know, Project Censored, that there is censorship in America, that there's a reason that there is a force preventing us from knowing these things.
Well, the corporate media has narrowed down to 10 major media corporations. They're interlocked with the military-industrial complex. They tell us what they think they want us to hear.
Right.
And you have to go to independent news, independent talk, Air America, Pacifica, you know, news, to really find out what's different. Because the big corporate news is telling you the way they want you to hear it. And they hire PR firms to write and produce videotape for news content, write stories, and even create stories. I mean, we all remember the story about the incubator babies in the first Gulf War. I mean, that was a Helen Nolan fictitious creation,
right,
whereby, you know, the ambassador's daughter from Kuwait goes on, says she's a nurse from the Kuwaiti hospital and that the Iraqis had invaded and stole the incubators and dumped the babies on the floor. It was a lie, and they knew it. The weapons of mass destruction was a lie, and we should have known it. And Judith Miller got away with that for a long time. And we're starting to see that and to recognize the degree to which corporate media will feed from PR firms and the State Department and the Pentagon and the White House. Isn't just Bush. I mean, this was Clinton as well. I mean, we get accused of being sort of the right-wing bashers of Bush, but you know, but look at our books in 96, 7, 8, and 9. You know, we were saying the same things about the administration in power then.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Peter Phillips. He manages the Sonoma State University's student-run media research group, Project Censored. We're going to go through a couple of these Project Censored stories. If you have a question for Dr. Phillips, our number 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Once was a green span guarding our economy. Bill made a surplus, that's good, Bill, said he. Then said the Bushman, if I make a deficit, you'll come up faulting Bill Clinton with me.
Faulting Bill Clinton, faulting Bill Clinton, you'll come up faulting Bill Clinton with me.
Oh, what a fine sport it is. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference. Our interview with Peter Phillips that you heard in the last segment was actually one that we had recorded some months ago because we were, as often happens when you're on a remote and doing a live broadcast, the hardware wasn't working. We weren't able to get the connection to the studio in New York working, but it's up now. Everything is fine. And David Sirota's on the line with us. David, you're supposed to be here.
I'm supposed to be here. I am recovering slowly from stomach flu.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's not last night, it's today, and I'm recovering.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you can be with us. One of the things that the messages that I'm hearing over and over and over again from guests who come on this program who are part of the Take Back America conference is that they are just so pleased that progressives are starting to have a loud and real voice in the Democratic Party. David Sirota, your take on that?
I think they're exactly right, and I think that the Democratic Party in Washington is extremely frightened by it. I think that the progressives are really making their voices heard. They're organizing. They're using tools like the internet to start asserting themselves both in the public sphere and I think we're seeing it even electorally. I mean, where I live in Montana, John Tester, the Senate candidate, overcame a Washington-backed candidate to crush him in the Democratic primary. So I think we're seeing the transformation of this movement from one that affects the public debate to one that's actually starting to assert itself in elections.
Yeah, and increasingly I just get this sense that politicians, mainstream Democratic politicians, in quotes, are starting to take seriously progressive perspectives, because as you so eloquently point out over at davidsirota.com and in your new book, and David, plug the book here right now.
Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back.
There you go. In your new book, Hostile Takeover, you talk about the fact that really the mainstream is not what the media refers to as the mainstream.
No, that's exactly right. And I think that the term centrist or center or mainstream as it's used in Washington is divorced from what is centrist and mainstream in the general public. And I think that the disconnect between the two ways the terms are used is deliberate. It's not by accident. It's the political establishment wanting us to believe, us, the majority of Americans, to believe that we are outside of the mainstream. It's a justification to push policies that are out of the mainstream. And I think that the progressive movement is essentially very smartly representing that the real center and forcing a debate between the real center and the distorted center that we're fed from Washington.
I'm right there with you, David. And you've seen this played out in Montana most visibly. Give us that story.
Well, the John Morrison is the state auditor, and he was running for the nomination for U.S. Senate, and he was running against State Senate President John Tester, and Morrison had way more money, and the Washington D.C. folks tried to essentially pressure Tester out of the race, and Tester said no. And when it came time for election night, a week and a half ago, Tester ended up winning 61-35. So there you see in the Democratic primary the progressive wing of the party really asserting itself and winning.
And as I said, and as you say in your book so eloquently, in Hostile Takeover, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party isn't really a wing of a party. It's really the view of well over 50% of Americans.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Go through a list of issues.
That's right. When you see the polls, it shows that the progressive wing of the party really does represent the mainstream. Most Americans want us out of Iraq, want universal health care, want our trade deals renegotiated to make them more fair. So the progressive wing of the Democratic Party really does represent the mainstream.
Mm. David Sirota, I'm talking with David Sirota. DavidSirota.com, his new book, Hostile Takeover. One of the most articulate spokespeople. David, we have about a half a minute left. Thoughts on Karl Rove's not being indicted?
Well, I think it's too bad, but I think that, you know, I think I sort of expected it because he's a guy who's done a lot of terrible things and gotten away with it over the course of many years.
Do you think he's rolling over on Dick Cheney?
What's that?
Do you think he's rolling over on Dick Cheney?
Yeah, well, that's possible. It's very, very possible. Let's hope.
Yeah, well, that was my initial thought when I got the news was, I thought, you know, this has got to be that he's given state's evidence on Dick Cheney because that's where, you know, the original indictment of Libby was pointing to Cheney.
Yep.
You know, in fact, the language in there said something specifically about, you know, Libby's superiors in the White House. So, okay, David Sirota, DavidSirota.com, the website, the new book, Hostile Takeover. David, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
And feel better soon. We need you. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
On September 12th, we had the world on our side. But George Bush, he started to divide. He cut off the UN and our allies, too. And now he wants to drive a wedge between me and you. But fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great.
And no, we're not going to let them. Actually, they're continuing to try this.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Amen. 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 Hey, last night, Steve King, Congressman Steve King, the Republican from Iowa, got up on the floor of the House of Representatives and repeated one of the most sad and tragic and disgusting of the Republican memes, where the Republican lies out there. First of all, the rate of deaths, of violent deaths in Washington, D.C. in 2004 was 35 people per 100,000, 35.8 per 100,000. In Iraq right now, as a country, it's 95 per 100,000. And keep in mind, the vast majority of the country of Iraq, the physical country of Iraq, is not actually in the middle of a war. It's mostly in a couple of cities, in a half a dozen cities, as the Republicans will point out to you. The areas up north, the areas controlled by the Kurds, by and large, not violent. So anyhow, this guy goes on the floor of the House, and he says, my wife lives here with me, and I can tell you, Mr. Speaker, she's at far greater risk being a civilian in Washington, D.C. than an average civilian in Iraq. And then he goes on to say 27.5 Iraqis per 100,000 die a violent death, which is not true. It's 90. And then he says 45 out of 100,000 in Washington, D.C., which is not true. It's 30, 38. Congressman John Conyers is with us. Just, hey, John Conyers. Congressman, welcome to the program. We are live and on the air right at this moment.
Good.
And so glad to have you with us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Tom Hartman. You've been doing this long enough to be known from one end of this country to the other. And the progressive analysis that you bring to what's happening in our government and to the country and to our American people is absolutely critical. And I'm happy to be with you again, this time in person.
Yeah, thank you for your kind words.
Pleasure.
It's really nice to see you and have you here. What do you see as the top issues right now before Congress?
Well, I could articulate them, but there's not much point in doing it because there are not going to be any hearings on them and there's not going to be any discussion about it.
So that's sort of the top issue, isn't it? The fact that the Republicans are running Congress in a way it's never been run before.
Exactly, and this is why in the Judiciary Committee, a number of us had to pull together what we call the Constitution in Crisis to really deal with this subject. And this is what caused me to create a select committee in which we could review the articles for which we can't get a hearing. We can't even get responses to our letters. We ask questions and they're routinely trashed or ignored. So to me, the next several months that will determine whether there will be a change in the leadership of the House of Representatives is absolutely critical so that we can move back to this tri-party concept of federalism, which has been totally ignored. The administration, with the president at the helm, has systematically intimidated most of the media. Thank goodness we've got so much web page activity, blogging, and networking going on among progressive media that it's different from the way it's always been. But not only have they intimidated the media, they've coerced the Congress into going along with them. And so, and in some respects, by continuing to fill the courts with conservatives, they're infiltrating the court system so that there'll be work for us to do long after this administration is gone.
We have long to go before we can sleep.
Yeah, that's right. Now there's a very interesting analysis going on about how the theocratizing of this government is going on, and it's kind of difficult because we don't want to confuse arguing with somebody's religion with their political. We're trying to keep these separate, but they're trying to keep them as close together as possible. And so we now have an evangelical religious community that is totally in the pocket of the President of the United States. And like him, they say they're getting their word from God. The President says that's where he gets his information. And so this is a very disturbing trend as far as I'm concerned.
It certainly flies in the face of the core concepts of the founders of this country of having a separation between church and state. You know, they saw what happened in England during that brief period back in the 1600s, or I don't remember when the English Revolution was, when the Puritans took over England for a while, and then they said, no, we'd rather have a king, you know. And they saw what happened in Massachusetts. I mean, when Ben Franklin left Massachusetts in large part because, as a teenager, because they were still burning witches. He was over it. And he went to Philadelphia, which was a very secular city.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely incredible. You talk about the fact that the Republicans are not allowing any discussion of really the significant issues. You're the institutional memory of the Congress in many ways. You've been in the House of Representatives for a long time and an outspoken and active voice. Republicans say, I've had people on this program say, well, you know, when the Democrats were in Congress, it was the same way. It was just the other way around. And you guys are just doing sour grapes. It wasn't the same way, was it?
Oh, no. No, it never was, because while we took advantages of being in the majority, we never shut down the process to the extent that we can't even talk about the key issues that everybody knows are the key issues. We're not able to talk about the Downing Street memo in the Congress.
Not one single hearing on it.
Nothing. Total silence. And here we've had it documented by us just collecting information from wherever we can and put it into our own web page, and then ultimately we will get it published.
Is that at johnconyers.com?
Yes, it sure is. And then we've had hearings, not congressional hearings, but just hearings on our own, because we knew that this had to be talked about, and just to walk around silent is like King said, there's a time when silence produces complicity.
Mm-hmm.
And what we said is that we've got to figure out how to do this. And so we said we'll form a select committee. We'll hold our own hearings. And, you know, it's almost like every week the Bush administration comes out with something new that takes you into another investigation for which there is no way that we can do it within our congressional process. It's tragic, but thanks to the progressive media, it's coming out. And also, there's been enough failure in the program that many people who were caught up in the fact that they thought that Iraq was an enemy about to attack America, which proved totally baseless, and that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were not in any way working together, and as a matter of fact, I contend that all the hundreds of billions of dollars that went into Iraq, not to mention 2,500 American military lives, took us away from the search for bin Laden.
Sure, sure. And now that Zarqawi has been killed, I mean, he had been up in the no-fly zone, up in the Kurdish area, up in the north, before we invaded Iraq. Bush had three opportunities to kill him. He was the only al-Qaeda guy in the entire country, and he was under our protection. Bush chose not to take him out before the invasion, because it would have minimized, he wouldn't have had an excuse that there's
right.
Al-Qaeda there any longer.
Yeah.
And now that he's killed, I mean, Bush just arrived in Iraq,
yes.
You know, just a few hours ago. They're trying to reconflate the idea of al-Qaeda, Iraq, and of course, implicitly 9/11 all over again, just in time for the election in 2006. You know, what a surprise. Congressman John Conyers, we have to take a break. Can you stick around for a few minutes? I'd like to talk with you about what happened in Ohio and some of your investigations there.
I may be able to come back, but it looks
you've got to move
iffy
on.
Right
yeah.
now.
Okay.
Well, but I'll try to, Tom, because
yeah.
I enjoy the way that you conduct these interviews, because what you're trying to do is the same as what I am about, and that's trying to merely get the truth to the American people about what's going on in our country and around the world.
Congressman John Conyers.
Thank you
so much for being with us. JohnConyers.com, the website. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 46 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I am a patriot, and I love my country, because my son is all I know. I want to be with my family, people who understand me. I have got nowhere else to go.
And welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Michael Kazin is here with me. We're broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference here in Washington, D.C. Michael Kazin, a professor of history and an expert in U.S. politics and social movements in the 19th and 20th centuries, wrote a book, A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan. That a remarkable man.
Yes.
I think a lot of people think that he remember him only as the guy who argued the Scopes trial.
Yes, which was the end of his life.
Yeah.
He did a lot of other things in 30 years in politics.
And the reason why he took the position that evolution should not be taught in the schools.
He believed that Darwinism was being applied to society in deleterious ways and harmful ways.
Economically,
he believed that it was what he called a brutish philosophy, that was the survival of the fittest, dog-eat-dog. A lot of people who were in favor of eugenics, breeding people to be better people, and were Darwinists and got their ideas from Darwin. So for him, the science didn't matter so much. It was how it was being applied that mattered.
Right, and in fact, Darwin's cousin, whose name escapes me, was using Darwinism as a basis to justify Victorian-era economics.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. And of course, that's true for any great philosophy, any great body of thought. It can be used in many different ways.
Yeah. So Michael Kazin, How has the progressive movement in the United States changed since it first emerged or reemerged? Arguably, you could argue that the American Revolution was the first emergence of it. It reemerged in the 1890s, late 1870s. How is that progressive and populist movement different from the ones that we're seeing today?
Well, for the most part, that progressive movement was a progressive movement of working people and farmers. It was a progressive movement of people who worked hard for a living, were mostly religious people, were very much what we now think of as in the mainstream, or middle Americans for that matter. And those people who are now considered to be sort of sophisticated, cosmopolitan people, culturally, were more conservative. Gradually, and Bryan is part of that story, gradually, I think the definition of what it is to be a progressive changed, and those people who would have been considered cultural elitists 100 years ago and more began to be identified, rightly or wrongly, with progressivism. Now, of course, conservatives have made a lot of hay talking about limousine liberals and this kind of thing, but there's a measure of truth to it, to the extent that many people who call themselves progressives today are usually secularists. They tend to live in more cosmopolitan areas, though not only. New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, places like that, Boston. And so conservatives were able to sort of take over the populist mantle, so to speak, in part because many progressives lost the connection that they had to working people. And of course, it wasn't just the fault of progressives. It had a lot to do with the decline of movements of working people as well. But that, I think, is one of the most important changes. The magic term for populists in the late 19th century was producer.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do something useful for society. And that, I think, still should be the core of the progressive movement, people who do, you know, the hard work of society.
Well, back then there was this notion that if you if you were an employee, if you were a worker, if you earned a wage, that you were generating the wealth, a part of which was being taken by the owners.
Exactly.
And today, it has been completely flipped around and reframed to say that if you are a worker, you are taking a job which is offered by an employer. And in fact, you know, I mean, Bush and conservatives in general, even some, I mean, the mainstream media has even picked it up, the whole idea of creating jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Employers don't create jobs. Demand creates a demand for a product, and employers need labor. I mean, how do we flip this back?
Well, it's a long struggle. A lot of it has to be done by working people themselves. It's not just a matter of language, and you know, people have to get active in doing it. But even the language, employee, is a very weak term compared to producer or worker. And
so you would suggest that the word employee be replaced by the word producer, that we go back to that 19th century usage?
Well, I'm not sure we go back or not, but we have to be aware that when we say employee, that means you're connected to the employer.
Right.
As you say, the employer be connected to you.
Right, and the flow of then instead of a flow of money from up down from employer to employee, it becomes a flow of production.
Yes.
from the producer, mm-hmm, to the, what would the name be for the factory owners, the corporation?
Oh,
what would that have been called in the 19th century?
It would be called capitalist.
To the capitalist.
Yeah,
so
for the most part.
From the producer to the capitalist.
Yeah, of course now it's not just people who produce, it's people who serve as well.
Fascinating. Michael Kazin, is there a website for people can learn more about your work, Michael?
www.georgetown.edu and just type in Michael Kazin.
There you go, Georgetown University. Michael Kazin, professor in the Department of History. Thanks so much for being with us today. And being here at the Take Back America Conference.
Thank you.
Fine thing. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference here in Washington, D.C. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. Stick around, my friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Dan Robinson is here with me. He's attending the conference. He's a correspondent, congressional correspondent for the Voice of America. Dan, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Glad to have you here. The Voice of America was started during World War II, as I recall, as a way of speaking to the Germans.
That's right, yeah.
And as such, arguably, was a propaganda instrument of the United States.
That's true. I mean, if you examine the history of the Voice of America, it began in a World War II climate where this country was fighting Nazi Germany. And, of course, over the decades, it transformed, including the period of the Cold War, into an organization that also had a key mission, which was to present the news accurately, objectively, and comprehensively. And that, in fact, was written into the law in 1976 in what we called the VOA Charter, which at that point applied to Voice of America alone.
And 76 would have been the last year of the...
Jimmy Carter? We're going out of Jimmy Carter into...
Have been Jerry Ford, wasn't it? I can't do math that fast in my head. Which year was an election year? And which 80? 4 years behind 80 was 76.
I'm glad you know these things.
Yeah, 80 was Reagan. So
right.
Yeah, so I think that would have been the last year of the Ford administration. I mean, because really this was... transforming the Voice of America from a propaganda tool, which made a certain amount of sense. I mean, we were fighting for our lives, for the survival of Western civilization, many would argue, and I think perhaps accurately so.
Right.
Transforming the Voice of America from a 1940s propaganda tool into a voice of sanity, reason, and actual real news really was very consistent with the values of both the Republican and the Democratic Party at the time, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, of Eisenhower. And I would argue even probably Richard Nixon. I just can't imagine Nixon saying, let's use the VOA as weird as Nixon was, mm-hmm. let's use the VOA as a propaganda tool. He would know that it would have been transparently seen through.
I think you're right. I mean, I think the presidents over the decades have come to VOA. They've made speeches to our, you know, the audiences overseas over Voice of America airwaves. But I think both sides of the political spectrum always recognize the value of having an organization, although government-funded, that reflected the not only the journalistic values of the United States, but also reflected the broader cultural and social values of this country. And what's happening now, which I'm sure you were about to get to,
yep.
is that under the 2007 budget request from the White House, there is a proposal to eliminate all but a few hours of Voice of America's English language broadcasting. And there are many of us who think that's the wrong decision, even in a time of the global war on terrorism, regardless of what definition you want to give to that. It's the wrong thing to do, that this country needs to have all cylinders firing, so to speak, in that conflict.
Dan, I need you to get just a little closer to that mic, too. Is this because the Voice of America is committed to, and in fact by law must, tell the news as it is, and this administration would rather that the Voice of America was telling the news the way the administration wants it to be?
I'd have to say there are some people who have made that observation and presented that suggestion. I have worked for Voice of America for 30 years and always have been a journalist first. I have never...
And a representative of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I got out of college directly into VOA, and many of my colleagues came from commercial radio, from broadcasting, from television and radio, and have been in the Voice of America news structure for decades. What we're looking at now is having the core structure of Voice of America English broadcasting eliminated in the name of the war on terrorism, and it's a very disturbing thing for a lot of us.
It would seem that if America really does have values and really does live values that we want others to emulate, that we would want to talk about what our values are and how we're living them. And I have to say, and this is me speaking, not you, Dan, that if we have reached a point in the United States where talking about what we're doing, whether it's changing the rules on torture or imprisoning people in Guantanamo or whatever. I mean, I can come up with my list. If we reach the point where we're talking about these things in a way that is just stand-up, straightforward news, reflects poorly on our country, then instead of shooting the messenger, instead of going after the news carriers, it seems to me that we should be fundamentally reconsidering the values and behavior of our government. Now, you know, you're not a polemicist, you're a journalist, and I'm the talk show host here. My job is to rant, and I'm not going to ask you to. But that's my take on this, and it really concerns me that the BBC is out there, you know, with good, strong support from the British government, broadcasting the news. I've been on the BBC at least a half a dozen times.
That's right.
And they're just scrupulous in presenting all dimensions of an issue, of just, you know, straight up. And I've been on both on opinion shows on BBC where I've been debating people, and also, you know, as the subject of newscasts when I was in the UK speaking. And I mean, it's like Walter Cronkite used to be.
Yeah, it boggles the mind. I mean, for many of us and many in the press, and there have been a lot of articles on this in recent months. I mean, you and I are just sitting in front of a pie chart here, a bar chart that lists the BBC, Al Jazeera, China to Europe, China to South Asia, and Iranian radio, as well as another bar for China, above the Voice of America. And that,
now, is this English language?
That's in English. It'll be a very real representation of what will happen. We'll retain some broadcasts to Africa. I want to add something, though. You mentioned these programs that you've been on. Voice of America has a whole range of these programs. We have a live talk show as well. And the problem is that there's a shift taking place, and it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. In the name of the war on terrorism, there shouldn't be, you know, a wholesale decision to scrap almost all English broadcasting, because that's going to deprive millions of people around the world with that view into our culture and society. We'll continue to cover the news as we always have, but in English, it will be reduced.
Yeah, I've traveled through parts of Africa and parts of China where people actually listen to VOA and shortwave in English as their way of learning English.
That's right.
I mean, this is it's not just a newscast for a lot of folks. It's also their tool to become players in a global world where English has become the lingua franca, the language of commerce, the language of international diplomacy and so forth. So what kind of cuts is the Voice of America looking at?
Well, we're coming down to the crunch. Literally this week as we speak, there's a subcommittee in Capitol Hill, appropriations subcommittee that is dealing with the budget that includes the Voice of America and all U.S.-funded international broadcasting. And the decisions will be made, if not this week, in the next few weeks, because changes can always be made on Capitol Hill. If people are concerned about this, they want to write into the appropriations subcommittee. I think it's Congressman Wolf. That's up to them. I'm not going to sit here and encourage people to do that.
Republican
Frank Wolf of Virginia.
From Virginia.
But it really is coming down to a critical point. We're talking about a figure of $23 million or so that could save English broadcast.
$23 million. That's about an hour and a half's worth of the war in Iraq.
Yeah, I could also save some other languages that are being cut as well, like Turkish, for example. So, there are a lot of priorities. Everyone knows the budget is tight, but this is a really critical issue, and it's one that, many of the employees at VOA would like people to get behind.
And this is the way we represent ourselves to the world. I mean, the Voice of America is America's face to the world. This is how we are. We are saying, here's who we are. Here's what we're all about. And
good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, the good, literally. Now, what about the argument that is made by some conservatives that, or let's say some folks, this is not purely ideological, that the official instrument, the official voice of the United States should be, if not partisan, at least pro whatever administration is in power.
We have all heard that argument for years and years and years, and there are many who believe that's the case, and there are many, many more, I think, who believe that by broadcasting everything, the good and the bad, the warts and all of this country, including coverage of Congress, coverage of this government, that does this country, we're much better off for it.
Yeah, I so strongly agree. The toll-free number for Congress, by the way, if you'd like to call your member of Congress, is 1-888-355-3588. And, of course, if you want to dial directly into the switchboard of Congress, it's 202-225-3121. Once again, 888-355-3588. Let your member of Congress know that you support continued funding of English language broadcasts in the Voice of America and continued impartiality of the Voice of America. And the number on Capitol Hill, 202-225-3121. Dan, thanks a lot for being
Thank
with us
Thank you
this
very
morning.
Much.
Thanks for 30 years of work at the Voice of America.
Thank you.
It's a good thing you're doing.
Okay.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference here in Washington, D.C. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics and the Organic Wine Company. And thank you for patronizing our sponsors. We're broadcasting from the Take Back America Conference. As the day goes on, guests come and go. You're also welcome to call at any time you'd like. And into our, just our normal 9-866-440-8466. Ann Coulter, this is so weird. Last week, Tuesday I believe it was, last week, Coulter appeared on the Today Show, the morning show, and said that the women who were the wives of men who died in 9/11, who have banded together and called them the 9/11 widows, as they're generally referred to as, were, quote, self-obsessed women enjoying their husband's death, end quote. And so Brian Williams, the managing editor of NBC News, that night said Coulter's remarks were, quote, over the line, that line that is shared by just about everybody because some things, it turns out, are still sacred, end quote. I'm like, And now tonight, Ann Coulter is going to be on Jay Leno. It's like, have we become so obsessed with celebrity in America that celebrity in and of itself it is like the basis of listening to what somebody has to say? I mean, I'm just boggled by it that NBC is owned by General Electric, and they know, these guys know, people in the media know that at that level, at the level of the Today Show, at the level of the morning shows on the networks, that getting an author on can make a book, can push a book into the New York Times bestseller list, and refusing to get an author on can kill a book. Look at what happened with Kitty Kelley. Kitty Kelley wrote a book that called The Family, about the Bush family. They just laid it all out, warts and all, about George Bush's cocaine use, about Bush. There was a whole chapter about Bush Sr.'s 20-some-odd year affair with his private secretary, photos, the whole bit, the machinations of the various Bush brothers, essentially in some cases the crimes of Jeb and George and Marvin and so on. A very unflattering portrait of the Bush family. Very powerful book. Kitty Kelley, when she writes books about Frank Sinatra, she gets the A-list treatment. She's on all the big shows. Sinatra sues her. She wins the lawsuit. When she writes, you know, she writes books about anybody else. And Kitty Kelley is front and center. She writes a book about the Bush administration, about the Bush family. Nobody is disputing the accuracy of it. And I'm telling you, I was doing this program when Kitty Kelley's book came out, what, 2 years ago? Almost 2 years ago, as I recall? Yeah, in fact, just about 2 years ago right now. And we got the memo that everybody else got from her PR firm. And this is just like a PR firm. I mean, this is not like the government saying it. We got the memo, not from her PR firm, excuse me, from the Republican, one of the Republican PR firms. One of the very powerful, well-connected Washington, D.C. PR firms that said, please do not book Kitty Kelley. Please do not put her on the air. The message, I don't remember the exact language that they put out, but essentially what they were saying was the message she's putting out is going to be hurtful to America, as if George W. Bush and the Bush family are America. Right? And it was from that day to the next day, it was like a switch had been thrown. All of a sudden, there was no discussion of Kitty Kelley. Kitty Kelley wasn't on anybody's television program. She wasn't on anybody's radio program. She was nowhere to be found, and her book fell off the edge of the earth in terms of sales. You can buy used copies of the hardcover, the original hardcover, $30 book. You can buy used copies now for $1 because they remaindered the thing. They must have had 100,000 copies sitting around that didn't sell because of this media blackout on Kitty Kelley before the 2004 election. And so you have to get it that this stuff does not happen in a vacuum, and it does not happen by accident. And Ann Coulter getting the A-list treatment like this by NBC. Somebody at General Electric really wants this woman pushed. Somebody at General Electric has decided, or at NBC, one or the other, or all of the above, has decided that godless liberals need to be taken down. And that Ann Coulter is their tool to do it, or one of several. And you look back at MSNBC, at the most highly rated program on MSNBC in 2003, the most highly rated program, or late 2002, the most highly rated program, the most profitable program they had, the network that Dan Abrams has just been made president of, by the way, the conservative lawyer pundit who does the Abrams Report, he's now going to be the chief executive of the network. The most profitable, the most watched show that they had was Phil Donahue. And they took him off the air because of his views, because he felt that it would be harmful to America for us to invade Iraq. And that was a memo that came down from on high in General Electric down to MSNBC. And here now, NBC promoting Ann Coulter, I'm just boggled by it. I'm just boggled by it. And I hope that you will join me in letting the local affiliates of this network, at the very least, know that we can do without Ann Coulter. Thank you very much. This is not the kind of programming that we need. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this song. I could kill a couple minutes just talking to lieutenants about Saddam Hussein. I could grasp what they were saying and the dangerous game we're playing if I only had a brain.
Well, and here's the danger, is assuming he doesn't. Because I'm telling you, George W. is over in Iraq right now, using the death of Zarqawi, a guy that he had three opportunities to take out before we invaded Iraq, when Zarqawi was running a little training camp of sorts up in the north of Iraq, inside the no-fly zone, inside a territory controlled by the United States, had an opportunity to take him out, and didn't. And have a seat, Jan. He's doing his best with it. It's absolutely incredible what's going on. So, anyhow, moving right along here, Jan Kern is with us. A pair of headphones there you can toss on if you'd like. And Jan, you are Jan Kern, right?
I'm looking for Mary Keith, who's in the bathroom, who'd also like to.
Okay, great. You've got to get right up on this, on these microphones here, because there's a lot of room noise here. So, Jan, you're the director of the ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. ACORN.org, the website. What is ACORN?
I'm actually the director of ACORN's Living Wage Resource Center. ACORN is the country's oldest and largest grassroots community organization of low and moderate income people. We're in about 100 cities across the country. We have 175,000 member families, and we fight like a union in the neighborhoods. People join up and become members of ACORN, and they fight for the issues that matter to them in their neighborhood. But we also organize citywide and statewide, and we have a national presence now on issues like minimum wage and living wage. We fight against predatory lending for better public schools. A range of issues that affect low and moderate income people.
How did ACORN start?
We started in 1970 in Arkansas as actually a group of welfare mothers fighting that system and its injustices, and then decided that we needed to branch out into the poor neighborhoods in which those welfare recipients lived. And we became an association of community, of neighborhood organizations in Little Rock, Arkansas, and we've grown to, like I said, 100 cities nationwide.
That's marvelous. Now, one of the main focuses of your attention is the minimum wage.
That's right. ACORN has been a national leader in the living wage movement for over a decade now, and we've helped win ordinances raising wages for some of the country's lowest wage workers in 15 cities across the country. And then we set up a living wage resource center, which helped work with other labor, community, faith groups to pass 140 living wage laws that are now in the books. And now we're really expanding to the state level and passing statewide minimum wage increases. We were responsible for the Florida victory in 2004. We put a minimum wage initiative on the ballot there after the legislature wouldn't even look at the issue. We gathered nearly a million signatures, got it on the ballot, and won with 71% of the vote in November of 2004, giving a raise to 850,000 workers in Florida.
Wow. And showing once again that America is more progressive than our legislatures.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, minimum wage is a perfect issue. It's not a red state issue, a blue state issue. Polls show consistently upwards of 80% of Americans think that the minimum wage should go up, yet you have all these, you have Congress sitting on a $5.15 minimum wage for the last 9 years. That's tied for the longest time in our nation's history that we have not raised the minimum wage. So what you see is people at the grassroots level taking matters into their own hands and raising wages at the city level, raising wages statewide. We now have 20 states with higher minimum wages than federal. There are 6 ballot initiatives moving towards the November ballot to raise the minimum wage in states like Ohio, Arizona, Missouri, Colorado, and you're going to see voters coming out to support those initiatives in large numbers.
We're talking to Jan Kern. She's the director of ACORN's Living Wage Resource Center. And Jan, why don't the Democrats use this the way that the Republicans are using gay marriage. I mean, this is the perfect wedge issue.
Right. And in fact, that's what our hope is, that they do a better job than they did in the last election. I mean, I think the story is getting kind of old now, but Kerry kind of just did not associate himself very closely with the Florida minimum wage increase. And
we kind of let Edwards do that, carry that water for him.
Yeah, it was to his detriment. I mean, we carried the state of Florida 71%. We carried every single county in the state of Florida. We got over a million more votes than George Bush got in that election, and Kerry got 48% in Florida. Now, he didn't associate himself closely with our campaign. We're seeing a difference now. We're seeing governors and senators in the states where the ballot initiatives are moving towards the November election, stepping up much more. And I think they understand that if they want people to come out and vote, they've got to talk about something that matters to people. Yeah. And this matters to people. People in Acorn neighborhoods will turn out for a minimum, you know, put money in their pockets before they're going to turn out for some candidate that they may or may not trust, that may or may not even be talking about issues they care about. So we believe that by putting this on the ballot, it's not just good policy, but it's good politics, because we care if our members vote. We want to move people into voter registration and get out the vote efforts, and this is an excellent tool to get people motivated to vote.
Right. And has the Democratic Party institutionally taken any recognition of this? I mean, the Republican Party institutionally is, you know, gung-ho to end gay marriage and gung-ho to stop the burning of the flag. The Democratic Party, it seems, should be spearheading this.
There are party structures all around the country in these states that have taken a stand for the initiative. For instance, in Ohio, the Democratic Party sent out a letter and said to all of its, you know, all of our candidates and that are running and all of our incumbents, this is the issue. We support a minimum wage increase. So we're seeing a little bit more of that. And obviously, the Democrats in Congress, you know, they're lined up behind a federal minimum wage increase. They just don't have the power to move it. But have they taken it on to the degree that they should? Have they made it a major part of every message? Have they been, you know, pounding the streets and showing up at our rallies and actions and demand, you know, signing petitions? No, they haven't done it to the extent that they should. But we're seeing them do it, I think, as they see the writing on the wall here. This is an issue that moves people. And the Republicans are, you know, absolutely refuse to budge in Congress. This is an excellent opportunity.
Was it part of the party plan? Plank in 2004?
Was it
a plank in the platform?
I think so. Yes, it was. And Kerry talked about it, just not a lot, you know, not enough. And it would always sort of slide back to the middle class. We have to build the middle class. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to somebody as we need to give you a raise. We need to raise the minimum wage,
right.
You know.
And that resonates a whole lot more for the majority of Americans than we need to cut your taxes, frankly.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. This is an issue about fairness. It's about, I mean, and Americans believe if you get up every day, you work hard, you play by the rules, you shouldn't have to choose between heating and eating. I mean, these are just basic matters of fairness, and that's why these campaigns, you know, signing people up to sign a petition to get the minimum wage on the ballot is like falling off a log. I mean, it's
the first strong advocate for a living wage in the United States, and as far as I've been able to tell, the guy who brought that phrase into the lexicon was the Republican president Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, he was a champion for the living wage. Now, granted, a lot of it was after he was no longer president when he came back in the Bull Moose Party as a populist, but still, it was Teddy Roosevelt.
It's an old term.
Yeah. Has the Republican Party completely disassociated itself from this? I mean, do they have any official position on it? Where are they at?
Sadly, what we've seen from them lately is pretty, I think, just cynical politics. For instance, when Kennedy he's the champion of minimum wage increase at the federal level.
Ted Kennedy
has been trying to get it introduced, and sadly, you know, the Democrats aren't in the position that they can get a floor vote just by wanting one. So as the Democrats push and get louder, and as the grassroots pressure becomes louder, the only thing we've seen from Republicans is an alternative minimum wage that is embarrassingly low and that includes a bunch of ugly Fair Labor Standards Act rollbacks. So, for instance, when Kennedy finally got the Republicans to agree to let him attach a minimum wage vote as an amendment to the bankruptcy bill last year, Senator Santorum came out with an alternative. And I think the reason they're coming up with alternatives is they know they cannot just say, we don't want to raise the minimum wage. They know it is too popular. They don't say anything unless they're forced. And when they're forced, what they do is propose lower than should be tolerable minimum wage increases and add on a bunch of ugly things like overtime rollbacks, small business tax breaks.
Is this the stuff that was part of Santorum's
bill? Yeah, Santorum's bill included, for instance, everyone knows that if you work over 40 hours, you're entitled to overtime. He wanted to extend it so you had to work over 80 hours in 2 weeks, so you could work someone basically 60 hours a week and not pay them overtime. And
he called it 80 hours a week.
And they called it good point. And they called it flexibility. We want to have employees
work a week on, a week off.
We were just in a meeting with Santorum this morning, and they tried to argue with us. Well, he is for a minimum wage increase, so they know they want to say it, but in fact, there's absolutely no political will on their side to move it, or they would have moved it. But when we do get loud enough, they have to do something. But what we've seen is ugly proposals that we frankly wouldn't support.
Jan Kern, the director of ACORN's Living Wage Resource Center, ACORN, ACORN.org, the website. Jan, we just have a minute left. What can people do who are listening to this program to get involved in this?
Well, we have a website called, you can go to the ACORN website or just go right to raisewages.org, and it shows you which states are moving ballot initiatives on this right now. So there are, like I mentioned, six states that are moving ballot initiatives. There's an additional at least six states that are significantly on the verge of legislative victories: California, North Carolina, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. So if you live in any of those states, or in Arizona, Ohio, Nevada, Montana, Colorado, Missouri, these are states where you can either get directly involved in a ballot initiative fight for November, or you can call your center representative at the state level. Now, at the federal level, I guess the easy answer here is just call your senators and representatives and say, I want to support the you must support the Kennedy minimum wage increase in the Senate for $7.25, and in the House it's George Miller's bill, $7.25 an hour.
Great. Jan Kern, director of ACORN's Living Wage Resource Center, the website acorn.org or
raisewages.org.
Thank you, Jan. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I care not for the polar bear. I hate the caribou. I love the sound of gushing wells and black gold bubbling through. Halibut, halibut.
Oh, it's the Halliburton song. As Mr. Blackwell comes through, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 50 minutes past the hour, coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. John Kerry at the Take Back America Conference just said, we were misled. We were given evidence that was not true. It was wrong, and I was wrong to vote for it, the war in Iraq. Susie Turnbull is with us. She is the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. And, Susie, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
Democrats.org, the website. And, Susie, your response to what John Kerry just said.
I think he's right. I mean, I think that what he said, and I think what most members are saying right now, is that we were misled, and that what we have from this administration is anxiety politics. People worrying more about fear and trying to change things instead of being worried about hope. I was reading last night, actually, in Daily Kos, and people were talking about how what we should be talking about is hope, and I think they're exactly right.
Yeah, I agree. This morning at this conference, Hillary Clinton spoke, and she essentially was defending her ongoing defense of the invasion of Iraq. People were booing when she was followed then by... Nancy Pelosi. And Nancy Pelosi essentially attacked the invasion of Iraq and got huge applause. And now John Kerry coming out. Is this, you're the number two person in the party. Is this a schism in the party, or is this the way it should be?
I think it's the way it should be. I mean, what we've seen, and one of the biggest problems that we've seen with this administration has been the people falling in lockstep with this administration and not questioning and saying, okay, we'll move ahead and we'll do it this way because Bush says so or Karl Rove says so. And I think that what we need to be doing is looking at it and examining things. I mean, some of the greatest advice I think we as a party have been getting has been from the media, including Tom Friedman, for example, who can talk about how where we are in Iraq, what and how if this was in the Caribbean, we would not be fighting in the same way as we are in Iraq because of oil and because of the economic aspects of it.
Yeah, yeah. Tragically. I'm no Tom Friedman fan, so you just pushed a button that I'm just going to let slide by.
No, I'm sorry, Tom.
Because we don't want to get into an argument about or a discussion or whatever. Maybe we do. I don't know about our international trade policies. You know, why don't we go back to tariffs? What was wrong with that? But that's kind of policy wonk stuff.
Right. I mean, one of the great things about this conference and the Campaign for America's Future, the Take Back America conference, is that there's a lot of conversation going
sure.
out there. A lot of conversation that basically triggers ideas and people thinking about different ways to look at solving problems. And I think what we as a Democratic Party need to do and what we as a nation need to do is take some of this politics out of it and make it policy-driven.
Yeah.
And what we've had for the last 5 years, 6 years, has been total politics.
Pure and simple, yeah. Susie Turnbull, the Vice Chair of the Democratic National Committee. Have you read Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s article in Rolling Stone?
I was in Ohio the week it came out. And I have not read it, but I sort of lived it. I'm originally from Ohio and am working very closely with the gubernatorial and Senate candidates, Tom Strickland and Sherrod Brown.
Yeah.
And basically, there is no question that Ken Blackwell did things in Ohio that changed the election and changed our future.
Yeah, and Kennedy asserts that we're, number one, frankly, illegal. Number two, a whole series of things, and this is not even getting into, you know, the potential for rigged voting machines. And this is just good old-fashioned Jim Crow and ballot stuff, you know, ballot stuff, whatever.
Ballot stuff.
You know, the whole thing. I mean, number one. And number two, Kennedy says he can document over 350,000 votes that were either stolen or flipped that Kerry actually won Ohio. I mean, that's a very, very strong statement to make. I'm wondering what the Democratic Party is going to do about the fact that in the last three elections, I'm from Oregon. We saw this in Oregon, where there were guys setting up these little card tables in front of shopping malls. Would you like to register to vote? You register. This is a company paid for by the RNC. You register to vote. If you click Democrat after you leave, it goes into a separate box and they get shredded. People then, you know, show up to vote, and guess what? You'll have to have a provisional ballot, and your vote never gets counted. You don't even know that your vote never gets counted. What's the Democratic Party going
to
do about this?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, from 2000 to 2004, what we focused on was making sure that people got provisional ballots. Okay, well, then they came up with another scheme and theory, and that was how they moved...
They bump polls. People off the rolls.
They bump people off the rolls, number one, altogether. The other thing that they did was they didn't have enough voting machines in certain places, and they kept people in line for 12 hours. I was down in Florida the day of November 2nd, and the week leading up to it in 2004, and what we had were lines and lines and lines for early voting because they had two machines in all of Palm Beach.
We have just about a half a minute left.
Okay, what we have to do, first of all, we reviewed this, and we need, state by state, unfortunately, we need to take back those states, because until we take back the states and take politics out of the Secretary of State's office, secretaries of state who are running those campaigns and running those illegal operations, we can't win, because this Congress isn't going to turn around unless we do.
Should we have national legislation to say that a Secretary of State cannot be a partisan office?
I think that would be a good thing. Susie
Turnbull, the Vice Chair of the Democratic National Committee, good to know that you guys are on this. I mean, this is a big issue. Democrats.org, of course, the website. Susie, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. We'll be back right after this.
been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
It's past the hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Richard Murphy is with me. Richard Murphy is you're a vet. You're active duty. Whoop, hang on just a second. Let me turn your volume on. There you go. Try it again.
I'm a member of the Army Reserve right now.
The Army Reserve.
Yes, sir.
And the Army Reserves are, let me back up a little bit. You spent 15 months in Iraq, 2003 to 2004.
Yes, sir.
During that time, you were also part of the Army Reserves?
Yes, sir.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the difference between the Army Reserves, and, well, there's not like an Army National Guard, is there? There's an Air National Guard. There is an Army National Guard? Forgive me.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So enlighten us here about these three, first of all.
Well, the active duty, it's their full-time job.
Right.
They're professional
soldiers.
That's
your basic GI.
Yes. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Reserve and National Guardsmen, we drill 2 days during the month and for 2 weeks during the summer. But we're always ready for deployment.
And then the National Guard.
The National Guard is just about the same as the Reserves. They do the 2 weeks of the summer and one drill weekend a month.
Right. But my understanding is the fundamental difference between the Reserve and the National Guard is that in the Reserve, you're basically, in time of emergency, mobilized to go into the Army or to become an adjunct to the Army, whereas the National Guard is a remnant of the original state militias that was the original Army in the United States when this country was founded and are, at least theoretically, legally, I believe, under the control of the governors rather than under the control of the Pentagon. And the role, since it's been a long time since we've had to mobilize the National Guard to put down an insurrection, I think the Whiskey Rebellion in 1797 was the last time it happened, but the National Guard's role has primarily been putting out forest fires, dealing with emergencies, dealing with crises domestically to guard the states. Okay, so we have that frame. Now, the Bush administration has done something very different with the Guard and with the Army Reserves, and I'm assuming that there are reserves for other branches of the service as well?
Sure.
Is there a Naval Reserve, Air Force Reserve,
yes, sir.
Marine Corps Reserve? Okay, with the Reserves. They've done something qualitatively different with the Guard and the Reserves than has been done in the past, and that is essentially using you guys as if you were a regular Army, just throwing you out there and saying, okay, you're deployed for a year, and it's not a state of national emergency. It's just Bush doesn't want to add more people to the Army.
My first 2 years in the Reserves were spent all on active duty. So
yeah, which is not how it's supposed to be, right? It's supposed to be the other way around. I'm sorry about that. Here's the hook. You guys, 2 years of active duty, and yet you have no health care.
That's correct.
This is nuts.
And it's a matter of national security, as far as I'm concerned. And we at IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, are very concerned about this, that almost 10% of reservists and National Guardsmen show up for their deployments unfit for duty.
Unfit for duty?
Unfit for duty.
You need to get a little closer to the mic. How so?
Well, anything from really bad dental issues to any medical condition you could imagine.
In other words, they have health problems that they haven't been dealing with, by and large, probably because they don't have health insurance or just pocket money to pay for that kind of stuff.
That's correct. And about 40% of junior enlisted soldiers in the Reserves and National Guard do not have health insurance.
Why is this?
Because it's never been extended to them.
Is this because historically we viewed the Guard and the Reserve as, you know, basically weekend soldiers as something
as
you
a
do
a part-time
inside.
Force, yeah. Correct.
And therefore the assumption was that these folks had full-time jobs. And, you know, back in the days when fully a third of the United States was unionized, and two-thirds of Americans had health and full health insurance for their entire families just through their jobs normally, they didn't need it.
Sure.
But now times are different.
Exactly.
So we're talking with Richard Murphy. He's a vet with Iraq and Afghanistan, Veterans of America, IAVA.org, the website?
Yes, sir.
Right? Yeah, okay. What are you doing about this?
Well,
healthcare issue.
We're putting people's stories in front of the media. You know, I don't have healthcare currently. I served 15 months in Iraq. We have other.
And
veterans.
You're still in the reserve.
Yes, sir.
And you're still active duty, or whatever you call it.
Active reserve.
Active reserve. Thank you. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, we're trying to press the issue. We're trying to put it out here in the media, like I'm doing right now, with individual soldiers like me who've experienced this, and. You know, just getting the facts out there, getting the information straight from the source. And that's what Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is doing.
Do you have any concern, Richard, that unlike in the past, I think, when soldiers spoke out on issues that were generally not considered political, like benefits, I mean, that historically has not been viewed as a political issue. You know, if a soldier during the Vietnam War spoke out against the Vietnam War, that was a political issue. And, you know, Nixon would take exception to it and probably had some legitimate cause to. But, you know, talking about benefits. But this administration seems to have politicized everything. Are you and your compatriots in Iraq and Afghanistan, Veterans of America, who are speaking out on this issue, have any of you experienced any kind of blowback, any kind of punishment as a consequence? Are you concerned about that?
Well, if anybody wants to call it an entitlement, yeah, it's an entitlement. And I think if anybody's entitled, you know, our nation's citizen soldiers are entitled to health care. Mm-hmm. So if the word entitlement has kind of become a bad word in American politics, I think.
Yeah.
But if anybody's entitled, I think we are.
But you're not concerned that, for example, because you speak out, you might find next week you have orders to redeploy to Iraq as punishment?
No, not afraid of that. And, I mean, what do we have to be afraid of? I've been, you know, attacked in Iraq like 40 separate occasions.
Whoa.
You know, I'm not afraid of that.
Your mother bought your body armor?
Yes, sir.
Tell me this story.
Well, we were sent to Kuwait in May 2003, and my unit was given the Vietnam-era flak jackets, which cannot stop an AK-47 round, which is the most prevalent type of weapon, most prevalent type of ammunition in Iraq.
Now, in May of 2003, that was right after George W. Bush on the aircraft carrier said the war is over.
The end of major combat operations.
Yes, yeah. So the war ended and the occupation began, in my mind. But in any case, I'll continue the story.
Well, and I called my mother from Kuwait and said, Mom, I need body armor. And she really couldn't believe that this hadn't been issued to me. But like any good mother, she got on the Internet and bought me $660 worth of the best body armor she could find.
Wow.
Now, she's an elementary school art teacher. It's not like it was in her budget.
Yeah. Now, I understand that some active duty soldiers right now are being told that they can't use body armor that has been purchased by their family members for them. Is that still the case?
Yeah. The Army and the military, they say they've corrected the issue, and they're trying. Uniformity is very important, they've said that they've corrected the issue, and they don't want everybody wearing their own personal equipment.
Right. So the bottom line is what?
Bottom line is you wear what the Army gives you now, which does stop AK-47 rounds.
So there is decent body armor for our soldiers now.
Yes.
That's good news. That's good news.
Sure.
Back to the issue of health care. Is this something that – I'm assuming that this is something – talking with Richard Murphy. He's a vet, an Iraq war vet. He's with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA.org, their website. I'm assuming that this is something that's going to require federal legislation.
Yes.
To bring about. So really your efforts need to be concentrated at the level of the House and Senate, right?
Sure. And they've gone part of the way. Right now, for every 3 months you've served in Iraq or in the combat theater, you are offered a year of health care. It's nearly $1,000 a year. So... They're offering it, but nonetheless, it's exorbitant.
You still have to pay for it. $1,000 a year is not small money for a lot of folks.
I'm a student. I can't afford that.
Yeah, that's not good. So do you have any champions in Congress, or are there any major obstacles if somebody's inclined to call toll-free 888-355-3588, the toll-free number for Congress, and talk to their member of Congress? Are there particular members of Congress that somebody should call 888-355-3588 and talk to?
Sure. I mean, there are bills bouncing around right now, but just anybody calling their own personal member of Congress and getting that groundswell of grassroots support, I think that'll push it over the edge. You just can't disagree, I think, with health care for reservists and National Guardsmen.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you know, we need to go back to, like, the GI Bill kind of stuff. I mean, you know, just good benefits for veterans. My dad went to college on the GI Bill. It's like, what has happened to the way that we're treating our veterans? Richard Murphy, thank you for your service to your country, our country, this country, all of the above, and for being with us. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA.org, the website. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, don't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations we pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw ball standing. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it.
There you go.
Boss, the boss may persuade some poor damn...
Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Mark Crispin Miller shared this with me from William Betts. He says... Sorry about that. Somebody just threw a window up in front of me. He says, prior to 2002, nobody even debated the accuracy of exit polls. It's an amazing piece. We'll get back to this in just a minute. But right now, Gloria Totten of the Progressive Majority, progressivemajority.org, she's the president, just showed up at our table. Hey, Gloria.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Progressive Majority.
Progressive Majority is a national organization that has taken on the role of becoming being the candidate recruitment operation for the left. So we are literally building the farm team of the next generation of progressive leaders.
That's great. Are you doing this at... I'm assuming you're doing this on a national level.
It's a nationwide program, but it's focused on down ballot races. We're going to school boards and mayors and city councils and county councils and state legislatures. We're in six states right now: Arizona, California, Colorado, Washington, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. We're opening offices in Minnesota and Ohio, and our goal is to get to 23 states across the country.
Why did it take progressives so long? I mean, what you're doing is essentially what the Falwells of the world were doing literally in 1980. I mean, what, 30 years, nearly 30 years ago.
Right.
In fact, it really started after the defeat of Goldwater in 64. I mean, 67, 68 was when the first real major local organizing was taking place among conservatives, not among Republicans, among conservatives.
Right.
Where have the progressives been?
Well, let me first say that before I get to your question, that you are exactly right, that election served to galvanize movement conservatives who knew if they wanted to take power back, they had to start by working outside of the Republican Party. And you fast forward to today, you know, back then in 1978 when our conservative counterpart, GOPAC, was formed, Democrats had control of everything, state legislatures, mayors, the Congress, Jimmy Carter was in the White House. And they just said, listen, we're going to put together a 10-year plan. This isn't about ousting somebody from the White House. This is about taking control of government all the way up and down the ballot, and it's exactly what they did. Yeah. Now they control everything. They've got the majority of all of those bodies.
Including the courts now.
Yeah, exactly. I think what took us so long, Tom, is that progressives traditionally have eschewed electoral politics. We just haven't got in the game, frankly. And we, you know, for a variety of reasons, because we have a different relationship to power, because we think electoral politics is bad and full of compromise, and we think politicians are going to have to compromise once they get in there, so there's nothing we can do.
You know, all of that could have been said of conservatives before 1964 as well.
They were the demoralized, disorganized, and disenfranchised party, yeah.
Well, and there was almost a certain elitism. I mean, if back in the early 60s, you know, William F. Buckley had firing line on TV, and he'd hold court, and he'd go, always ponder this very carefully, you know. And I was 13 in 64, and my dad was in the Republican, you know, local Republican county, and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember that election so well. And, you know, within 3 years, I'd awakened.
Yeah. Good for you.
But I saw it up close and personal.
Yeah.
And saw the kind of how galvanizing actually it was when Goldwater went down in flames. The conservatives didn't get mad. They got even. I mean,
they
said, you know, we're gonna take back this country. And here we are 40 years later, and it's happened.
Yeah.
And so I'm so glad that you're doing this. ProgressiveMajority.org, by the way, the website. We're talking with Gloria Totten, the president of Progressive Majority. And Gloria, how do you derive your funding? How can people support what you're doing? What sort of outreach are you doing beyond just the candidates themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, we go into progressive communities and recruit people who are already activists and especially already leaders in the progressive movement and get them to consider running for office. Then we do an assessment of whether or not they should run for office if they decide they want to. We make sure they know where the best districts are for them to run to win. And then we provide every level of support that they're going to need. We are there from you know, cradle to grave, so to speak, that anything that they need right up until when they're elected, helping them figure out how they're going to be the most effective progressive leader in office.
We have about a half a minute left. If our listeners want to get involved,
they should go to the website. They can support all of our money comes from individuals and small donations. You can go to the website at progressivemajority.org, and you can also see and support our candidates there, too.
That's great. We're talking with Gloria Totten. She's the president of Progressive Majority, the website progressivemajority.org. Gloria, just final point. Well, we're out of. We hit the break.
Thank you.
Gloria, thanks for being here. I really appreciate what you're doing. This is marvelous. Really, really marvelous. If somebody in an individual state wants to bring you to their state, go to the website, check it out.
Go to the website. There's a contact us section, and just send us an email, and we'll be sure to get back to you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank
27
you.
Minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
From writers and critics who prophesize with your pen and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naping. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing.
There you go, you tell them, Bob. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Beth Schulman is with me. She's the author of The Betrayal of Work. Now, the website, lowwagework.org. Beth, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. You need to really get in on that microphone in order for it to pick you up well. The Betrayal of Work. There are a lot of myths around low-wage work in the United States. I think probably the most pervasive one is that low-wage workers are doing low-wage work purely because of a lack of education, for example, or that they haven't been able to, they're not really motivated to get out there in the workforce and find a good job, you know, that kind of thing. What are In your experience, what are some of the primary myths and what are the realities that belie them?
Well, first of all, we need to remember that we're talking over 30 million Americans are in low-wage jobs. So it's not a question of a few people. We're talking about one out of every four workers is in a low-wage job, and that's a job that pays less than $9 an hour, which is the federal poverty level. But a lot of the myths around low-wage work are one that, you know, these are jobs that really aren't important to our economy. They're kind of fast food jobs. And the reality is they're jobs that are absolutely at the central part of our lives and our economy. They're nursing home workers and child care workers. They're janitors. They're hotel workers. They're security guards. You know, they're food processing workers. These are jobs we rely on every day of our lives and are central to our economy. Second, that somehow these low-wage workers are, you know, they talk about them as high school dropouts, you know, or that they're somehow all undocumented workers. Well, the reality is these are adults like the rest of us trying to take care of their families. Two-thirds are white, majority are female. Again, this is the mainstream of our workforce in mainstream jobs. The other myth that I see around low-wage work I hear all the time is somehow this is just a force of nature, you know, that this is just the economy working. Well, the reality is we make decisions about how our economy works every day. We just need to make decisions that actually favor hardworking Americans, and we need to do that. The other thing that everyone talks about, well, if they just get more training, you know, everything would be just fine. Well, the reality is I believe in training, and low-wage workers are actually the least likely to get it on their jobs. However, these are the growing jobs in our economy. These are the fastest, 5 out of 10 fastest-growing occupations are in the low-wage sector. So we need to do something about the rewards of these jobs.
To what extent can we change that relationship between low-wage workers and their wage by virtue of government intervening in the marketplace and resetting the rules of the game? Conservatives would say, well, that what that's going to do is it's going to cause unemployment. History doesn't indicate that, actually, or that it would cause inflation. History doesn't indicate that either. If you go back and you look at every single time minimum wage has been increased, unemployment and inflation have both actually gone down in the subsequent years.
Absolutely.
But nonetheless, that's the myth. And the reason why that myth is so pervasive is because there's probably actually some reality to it. If the minimum wage were raised to $50 an hour tomorrow, then there would be significant dislocations in the American workforce. It's really a matter of threshold. So to what extent should we be looking at solutions that have to do with the government intervening, like, you know, living wage laws or minimum wage laws on the one hand, or on the other hand, the attempts that were made by progressives starting in the 1870s to reduce the size of the labor force? Getting child labor child labor was 30% of the labor force at the turn of the 20th century, and, you know, getting them out of the workforce increased wages overall, paved the way for the emergence of a relatively small middle class in that first two decades of the 20th century. But it did. The railroads in the 1870s, Jay Gould and Huntington imported over 180,000 people from China. China was having famines, so that was the most available cheap labor in the world. Brought them into the United States to work on the railroads. 90% of the people working on the railroads in the entire decade of the 1870s were Chinese brought in. And that led to a populist and progressive revolt, people saying, hey, wait a minute, again to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1880, which some people view as a very racist piece of legislation. In fact, it was, you know, if they'd been importing labor from Honduras, it would have been the Anti-Honduras Act. I mean, it was trying to limit the supply. So how do we balance this relationship between these two things?
Well, first of all, it's clear that tight labor markets certainly help low-wage workers. If we look at the end of the 20th century, we saw some of the tightest labor markets we've had in a long, long time, and we saw wages increase at the bottom.
Right.
However, saying that, it still was not sufficient. You still had about 30 million Americans making less than the poverty wage. They didn't have health care. They didn't have a lot of things we expected work to provide. You know, I think one of the things we need to remember is that many of the jobs we look to today as, quote, the good jobs, many of them in the manufacturing sector, weren't always good jobs. I mean, there was nothing inherently middle class about them. They became good jobs through social legislation and unionization. The same thing is happening today in many of the low-wage jobs. There's nothing inherently low-wage about a nursing home worker or a security guard or any of the ones I've described, or a janitor or a hotel worker. You know, unionized hotel workers in Las Vegas make $13-14 an hour, have health benefits, have time off and a pension because they're unionized. The same workers in Reno aren't unionized, and they make about $9 an hour without the benefits.
And
so
they're in essentially the same job markets.
Exactly the same job markets. So, I mean, it's, you know, we need to remember that obviously the right to organize a union is instrumental in making sure that people have an ability to move from a low-wage job into a middle-class job. Second, we need to ensure that we have standards in place that don't allow companies to choose the low road. Our minimum wage is $5.15 an hour. It hasn't been raised in 9 years. You know, if it had just kept up with inflation, it would be close to $8 an hour. So we need to ensure that we have an adequate minimum wage, that we have living wages which say that, look, if you're going to get taxpayer dollars, you've got to pay a decent wage and provide benefits. And we need to ensure that actually Americans have the right to organize a union in the United States.
Well, that's the biggie. I mean, in 1947, when Taft-Hartley was passed over the veto of Harry Truman, when the Republicans had taken control of both the House and the Senate in the election of 46, 35% of the American workforce at that time was unionized. It was a peak of essentially. I mean, it was a peak that echoed for several decades. But that was the high point in percentage terms of unionization in the United States. And for every union job, there's always another parallel job out there that's non-union, because the union job sets the floor. So you had 70% of the American workforce basically enjoying the benefits of unionization. Taft-Hartley made it possible for states to do what Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush trade policies have made it possible for multinational corporations to do, which is to say, oh, well, the labor's too expensive here, we're going to go over there. And so employers could leave a union-based state for a right-to-work, so-called right-to-work state. Now they can leave the United States and go to China. I mean, isn't there some really fundamental work that needs to be done here, rolling back Taft-Hartley and changing our international trade agreements as a start?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the things is many of the jobs I talked about actually can't be sent overseas. You know, when we talk about hotel workers or nursing home workers or child care workers, security guards, those actually have to be done in a specific place. But saying that, absolutely we need to do something about our trade laws. The way we've designed our trade laws are great for multinational corporations, but they're not good for working Americans. We need to have provisions in those trade laws that essentially set standards to ensure everyone has the right to organize a union. If you don't do that, then you shouldn't be trading with us. So that we put incentives for companies to go, again, do positive things by increasing their living standards when productivity goes up, for instance. But again, here at home, we can do things in terms of, again, setting some floors so corporations can go the low road and continue to pay, you know, $5.15 an hour, or even $6 or $7 an hour, which is an unlivable wage here in the United States.
We're talking with Beth Shulman. She's the author of The Betrayal of Work. What are the specific things that we should be doing?
Well, first, as I said, we need to raise the minimum wage. We've seen that at the federal level, it's stuck at $5.15 an hour. We've seen truly a revolution at the state level. 20 states now have a minimum wage law that's higher than the federal level because 80% of Americans believe in a hike in the minimum wage.
In Oregon, where I live, it's $7.25 an hour, I believe, or maybe it's gone to $7.50. I know it's going up. $9 is the poverty level. What should the minimum wage be?
Well, at least it should be at the poverty level.
$9.
And again, that's just a beginning. I mean, the other problems with low wage jobs is that these workers are the least likely to have any health care.
Sure.
And we are the richest country in the world. We should ensure that everyone, not just the few, have an ability to get health care and get it so that they get access and they can afford it.
Yeah, and if we created a $9 minimum wage across the board, in inflation-adjusted dollars, isn't that pretty much back to where it was in the 50s?
Right. Essentially, we're giving a little raise, but not much. We're essentially saying in 1968 it would have been about $8 an hour. So, you know, we're not giving anybody any great wage hikes here.
Yeah.
And as we all know, the cost of housing, gasoline, child care, and all the other things that we have to pay for every day are skyrocketing.
Gone through the roof. Beth Shulman, she's the author of The Betrayal of Work, the website lowwagework.org. Beth, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Good speaking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program broadcasting live from Washington, D.C.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. The Reverend Paul Sherry is with me. He heads the Anti-Poverty Program for the United Council of Churches. You're the former president of the United Methodist Church.
United Church of Christ.
United Church of Christ, thank you. The United Church of Christ. And the national coordinator of the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign, letjusticeroll.org is the website.
You got it.
People want to check it out. Reverend Sherry, morality, this seems like a much more important moral issue. It affects, as we just heard from Beth Shulman, at least 30 million Americans. A much more important moral issue than gay marriage, however arguable that may be, or flag burning, fill in the blank from the right wing.
I could not agree with you more, Tom. Trying to raise the minimum wage to assist poor working people and their families is at the very heart of what morality is all about. And if faith-based communities are not concerned to help people raise families, meet basic health care needs, basic housing needs, if we don't do that, our faith is worth nothing. So the Let Justice
Roll... paraphrase...
Worth nothing.
Yeah.
So the Let Justice Roll Living Wage campaign is focused sharply in two areas. Raising the minimum wage at the federal level, which is very difficult right now, but also working at the state level to raise minimum wage, either through legislative victories or indeed through initiatives put on the ballot.
And we're
very encouraged. People are responding.
And you folks have been directly involved in some of these campaigns.
We have, very much so.
Give us some examples.
Three in particular we've been involved with so far where we've had victories. We won a resounding victory not many weeks ago in Arkansas. We assisted in a major victory in Michigan, and we led a partial victory, at least in West Virginia. We now have organizers in the states of Ohio, Montana, Missouri, North Carolina, and are working closely in other campaigns in places like Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and elsewhere. It's a campaign, we think, whose time has come, and people respond with power. That's what's so encouraging.
This is absolutely marvelous. The letjusticeroll.org, the website, we're talking with the Reverend Paul Sherry, National Coordinator for the Let Justice Roll campaign. You've had some victories.
We have.
You've had some starts. And yet you've been operating in a realm that is relatively nonpartisan.
We are nonpartisan. We are strictly nonpartisan. We're a body made up of some 70, 75 organizations, national and regional, faith-based, community-based, labor-based. And yes, we've been winning across political lines because people from all walks of life, all points on the political spectrum, see the morality of people who work for a living receiving an adequate pay for an adequate day's work. The phrase that I love to use is a job should take you out of poverty, not keep you in it.
Now, back 25, 30 years ago when the Republicans were out of power and they were trying to figure out how to get back into power, they said, well, let's bring together a coalition of people
right. And
make them Republicans, bring them into the Republicans, so we'll bring in the homophobes and we'll
right. Bring
in the gun lovers and we'll bring in the, you know, you can come up with a list. We all know the list. And they've been successful in doing that, in bringing those people into the Republican fold and thus growing the Republican Party and seizing national power. I'm curious to what extent, since your you're very successful. You're out there. Your organization is out there, and the organizations that you're associated with out there in the world. To what extent you have been invited by either of the two political parties to participate in partisan politics?
Well, I'm asked the question often in interviews like this. Are you simply a stalking horse for one or the other of the parties? And our answer is no. We are non-political. We're not based on a political platform. We're based on a moral platform. And we hope to attract people and institutions and organizations from across the spectrum. And that being the case, we believe that's one of the reasons we've been successful so far. People see the morality of this as well as the economics of it, no matter where they are in that political spectrum.
But Reverend Sherry, just like Jerry Falwell and his merry band got tremendous political power as a consequence of their affiliation with the Republican Party, Ralph Reed and all these guys, It seems that there would be an opportunity here if you were to affiliate yourself with the Democratic Party, because I doubt the Republicans are going to go out of their way to help you. If you were to openly affiliate yourself with the Democratic Party, to actually create a symbiosis that will produce more of the results you're trying to achieve.
Well, yes, but you remember, we're 501c3 organizations. We're nonpartisan organizations.
Well, so is Jerry Falwell's.
Yes, that's his problem.
Okay.
So that we feel that we can do a much better job, can be far more effective, can help more people and more families by staying nonpartisan, but staying on the issue. Focused as we can. And frankly, I believe we're going to have several more victories in the immediate months ahead. And I believe this fall, we may get, since 1997, the first raise in the minimum wage at the federal level.
That would be great. Is it going to come with Rick Santorum's little gotchas?
Oh, boy. We will not allow that to happen. You can count on it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing that he would have the gall to do that.
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Cynical.
But it's, I suppose, given that it's Santorum, it should have been predictable.
Perhaps.
But
Pennsylvania, you know, is working very hard right now for a state minimum wage, and they're getting closer and closer, a raise in the state minimum wage, and they're getting very close to it.
We're on the air in Pittsburgh right now, WPTT.
Oh,
Pennsylvania listeners should go to letjusticeroll.org and get more information?
Absolutely. More information, and indeed to get to those senators on both sides of the aisle. Press them to get this onto the floor so it can be voted on.
Great. The Reverend Paul Sherry, the former president of the United Church of Christ, the head of the anti-poverty program, the United Council... National Council of Churches. Thank you. Type it wrong here. And Let Justice Roll, the website, national coordinator of the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign. Check it out. Thanks so much for being with us today, broadcasting live here from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.